lovers, it's Kristen Hange, and I am going rogue. It's just me by myself to tell you this is our 100th episode, and as you're having a little dance party about that, we are having a live and in-person create this Tuesday, January 29th at the Royal Family Theater. That's right. If you want to see Natalie and I in person, we are 7 to 9 p.m. at the Royal Family Theater. It's 145 West 46th Street, and we are talking about when you give your power away. So come play and party with us, and we'll all get tapped into our own inner power. And until then, enjoy our 100th episode.
Do you know what I love when we have like a really magical, exciting opening sound is watching the feedback bars.
Yeah, like it's saying you guys are too much and we say we know and we would do it again.
Take it. Take all of our too muchness. I am so excited because guess what? There's so many reasons.
There's so many reasons. And I know all of them, but I'll let you tell everyone.
Oh, well, I'll just say the first one out loud is it's our 100th episode.
100! And we don't look a day over 24.
We don't look a day over 24 episodes. I can't believe that we have hung out together 100 times.
I can't believe we've hung out together 5,000 times and only recorded 100
times. I know. I just want everything to be recorded. I also have other reasons I'm excited, which is we have taken over the back house yet again.
Yeah, we basically moved in.
Yes. Actually, Rob and Kristen Bell are going to find us like on their doorstep with our luggage being like, what room is ours?
We actually have decided that we've kidnapped Kristen Bell. Kristen's here with us again. You remember her from our last podcast and us gossiping about how much we love her. So we kidnapped Kristen and we all had a beautiful brunch today. Mm-hmm. And then we came back to the back house and we had so much fun girly time. And now we're here doing a podcast waiting for a very special guest. I don't even know if we want to tell them.
We're not going to tell them. But I mean, it might be in our podcast description, but maybe they just hit play and they didn't even read the description, and so they're going to be very surprised.
For some of you who've been listening to the podcast, you might remember 2 or 3 podcasts ago, I talked about my deep crush for this individual.
Yeah.
And now he's coming, and I can't wait to tell him.
You're going to tell him live and on air about your true feelings.
I'm going to tell him about my love for him.
I'm excited. You know, it started because I started with a mild crush on him first.
You introduced me.
Yeah, I heard him on Rob Bell's podcast, and I was like,
And then we Googled him.
Uh-huh.
And there was all kinds of cute, sexy pictures.
Yes.
And then Kristen shared the pictures with me, and I was like, well, who is this person?
And then you listened to him talk, and then you started to have all the feels.
Yeah.
And then I felt like I gave him to you. It's very rare that you and I would have a crush on the same person.
It's so true. We have very different tastes, but sometimes there's a crossover.
There's a crossover. Yeah. It's like, are they dirty enough for me? Are they polished enough for you? And are they a deep spiritual channel?
For both of us.
Yes, exactly right. And in that place, the overlap.
There is a magic human. The one size fits all.
The one size fits all. What's your type, Kristen Bell?
I found my type when I was 18.
Oh! Yeah. I can't believe you knew what your type was at 18. You're a woman with vision.
I didn't know for sure. We were friends for 5 years before we started dating.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, just because we were in college and other things happened. He dated other people, I dated other people. But then
Couldn't shake it. You couldn't shake it.
Oh, well, that's when you know. Because you can't shake it.
You can't shake it. And you don't want to.
Oh. Something inside of you knows.
Yeah.
So something inside of you just knew this is my person.
I really did. I don't know. I mean, I was so young when I knew. I think I was maybe 21.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I look back on that. How in the world would I know? But I did. I had a deep knowing.
Oh.
That we were going to grow up together. We were going to grow together.
Whoa.
I
love the deep knowing.
Well, and isn't it that way with our dreams, too?
Yeah.
When you get in connection with something you really want to create, you just know.
You just know.
And you don't know the how, and you don't know any of it. You don't even know how it's possible. You can't see how you could even do this thing, but you just know.
It's
worth it.
Yeah. And I always feel like part of the reason why we have this podcast and we've done 100 episodes for it is because we all know there's a deep wisdom in our heart. And what it is we love is the thing that pulls us forward. And giving ourselves permission, a collective permission, yeah, let yourself be pulled by your heart. Because if you try to do any other path, it's just not going to work. And that thing inside your heart that says, come here, do this, follow this, is never going to go away.
Mm.
So we might as well just collectively decide, well, since you're calling, I will answer.
Mm. It's so true to think about it that way, a phone that is always ringing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many people I know who say, it's too hard, I just want to give up. Whether it's a relationship, whether it's your dream, whether it's this creative baby you're working with. It's like, I can't see the house, or it just feels too hard, it feels too sticky, or I want to be an artist, or I want to do this thing, but it's just not happening and I feel stuck. So you think, I'm just going to quit. I'm just going to walk away from it. But the phone keeps ringing. You can decide not to answer it, but the phone will never stop ringing. And so it's actually easier to just pick up the phone and say, okay, quitting isn't an option because my dream's never going to quit me. So if I just take leaving off the table, what else becomes possible?
Well, that's really interesting because I think the reason people quit is because they can't see the how. They don't see how it's possible, and the obstacles seem too big, so bailing seems like their best option, but it's actually so painful to bail on what you love.
Yeah.
It's too painful.
It's more painful to bail on what you love than to do what you love and fail.
Right. And that's where addictions come in, right? We want to, so when we bail on what we love, whether it's our dream or that relationship thing or whatever that thing is that we bail on that is our calling. It's our authentic soul's blueprint. When we bail on it, we find ourselves in more pain. And then in that pain, that existential pain of being a human who's not following your heart, you have to numb the pain in order to exist.
Mm.
Right? And that's where...
Oh, and so it's fascinating how we move away as a means to protect ourselves.
Yes.
But the more we try to protect ourselves, then there's more pain to try to numb.
That's right.
To move away from.
That's exactly right. Right? So until you're trying to get to the place so that you're putting anything in that pain just not to have to feel it. But that pain is a beautiful motivator. It's saying you've moved away from what you love.
Mm.
Now, I know it's scary. Let's all hold hands. That's why we do this podcast about community moving towards authentic expression, is let's all hold hands together and say, hey, let's just keep moving towards what we love. And we can share our tools that we develop together on, this is how I move towards what I love, even when it's scary, even when I don't know how, even when I'm afraid of hurt and pain and rejection. I allow my heart to be so open that the energy inside of my heart propels me. You know what I was telling you, Kristen Bell, this morning is my morning reading. I just opened up a book randomly, right? And the book I opened up is because I'm staying at my friend John DeVinci's house, and he had Gabby Bernstein, her book, The Universe Has Your Back. And so I did one of those, you know, the magical things of universe, tell me what you want me to know. And I opened it up and it said, see all the love around you and expect miracles.
Mm.
And I was like, ooh, that's great as my only job today. I'm just going to see the love that is all around me and expect miracles. And I was just thinking about that in terms of our dharma, or the thing that calls our heart, the thing that is propelling us. How often do we wake up and expect miracles with that thing?
Oh, yeah. Never. Because we expect that we have to be the doer to create some sort of miracle for that thing. We never trust that that thing is a miracle. My relationship to it is a miracle. And there's something miraculous that happens in our collaboration that I can't even imagine, that can't happen from me without it.
So when I expect a miracle, it actually changes my relationship with it. I was just thinking about the meditation that you shared with Kristen, and I do mind sharing with our listeners about the making the fire.
Yes.
Just the vision that you had.
Yeah. So I was speaking with my acupuncturist and she said, let's do a meditation where we go in and see the inside of your heart. And I could see myself inside this thick forest of trees and I was just desperately putting twigs together trying to make this fire. And she said, well, why do you think that you have to be the source of light? Where's the sun? And I said, well, I guess it's there, but I can't feel it because I'm in amongst all these trees. The sun representing love, you know, God, the source of love and light in the world. And it's like, I'm so busy trying to be the creator of light, trying to be the doer, that I forget that there's this huge source that is for me. And I said, but I can't feel it because the trees are too thick. And she said, well, stop wasting your energy trying to make light and just climb the tree. Just climb the tree. Go where it's warm.
Go where it's warm. And then that makes me think of, if we expect a miracle, it's like we're going up and expecting there is a source of love that is here, that is shining down on us, that's doing it for us.
Right.
Like we have to climb the tree or we have to open, we have to walk in the direction of our dreams.
Say yes to the Dharma.
Right.
Say yes to the one next action.
But it wants to surprise us. The divine wants to say, hey, I'm here. All those obstacles of why you don't want to go there or you don't want to even enter into the conversation or you don't want to go on the path because you think they're too big. I know what to do with them.
And they are too big for me.
For my little
body and my little brain.
Yeah.
It is too big.
Yeah.
But not for the whole engine behind the whole thing that wants my dream in the world and wants me to be the vessel of that thing.
That's right.
And you just said something about, yes, that was like so bringing me back to our conversation with Kristen this morning. My two Kristens.
You're in a Kristen sandwich.
We were talking about the power of yes. And you were sharing about yes as like the beginning of.
Right. Saying a big yes. There was a big yes that I said, and it has opened up all these other yeses.
Right.
I just feel the yeses flowing.
And the opportunity to say yes to more things just from that one place of saying, let me just open the door. Let me walk in this direction. It's like we think we have to have all the steps or all the path, but really all we have to do is say yes. This dream has showed up. This idea has showed up. This book that wants to be made through me has showed up, or this song that wants to be made through me has shown up. Can I just say yes to it? And I don't even have to know what that means.
That's right.
But that one yes will incite and ignite this whole domino effect of other yeses in your life that may have to do with that thing, may have to do with your love life, it may have to do with your kids, it could have to do with so many other things, but just being that person who says yes to that thing will start having a ripple effect in your whole life. Loved that.
Oh.
It feels like the year of yes.
Oh, doesn't it? Well, we'll just declare it. This is what we're doing. This is what the three of us are doing.
It's saying yes to, we're saying yes to the big yes.
Yeah.
The big yes inside of our heart.
And we're talking the spiritual yes. We're talking the yes from the calling inside of you. You know, it's not a yes to, you know, let me make more money or let me, I mean, I believe all of those things can come from your spiritual yes, but this is about what is the calling inside of me? What is the opportunity inside of me that's knocking? And how is it my job, my bliss, my ecstatic bliss to have the opportunity to even say yes to it? It kind of makes me feel like the most beautiful, phenomenal human being shows up in front of you and it's like everything you've ever asked for. And instead of just saying yes to, let's just go for a walk or let's just hold hands or let's just see where this goes, we're like, well, what if it doesn't work out? Well, what if this doesn't happen? Well, I don't know. What if they don't like me the same way I like them? And so we're already saying no and the present just arrived.
Oh, before we've even like...
We haven't even opened it.
We haven't even taken the step.
Man.
So it's...
At least have a one-night stand before you say no.
Listen, you know me. There's an authentic yes in my heart. To whatever comes knocking, the where my heart goes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting as we start to talk about this year, because I do think saying that big yes, that authentic yes, means spending a certain amount of time in your heart where you can really listen and say, tell me what it is you really want. And that means, where did I take certain things off the table that are what I really want so that I can hold and claim what it is I truly want? those deep yearnings, the deepest desires, and reclaiming that so that we can say yes to them. And that means building the field where all things are possible. Mm-hmm. You know, knowing that we live in infinite possibilities. When we start from that place of anything is possible, we are magicians, you know, starting from that place, what is it that my heart wants in the most true, passionate way? And there's a buzz there.
Yeah.
You know, when you really say yes to your heart, you feel an ignition. There is something that clicks, a catalyst, there's a power. And you know inside of your body tells you.
Mm-hmm.
So may we give ourselves that permission to feel that deeply from our heart.
I was telling the story once, I think even on this podcast, about doing this meditation retreat and feeling like, oh, I'm going to nail this. Like the first hour, 2 hours, I was meditating, having the best time. By like the second, third, fourth hour, I'm like, I can't meditate anymore. I can't meditate. What time is it? What's everyone else doing? Where's my watch? I wonder if anyone emailed me. And it was this really interesting thing of, I don't want to be with myself. And the calling is go deeper, go deeper.
Ladies and gentlemen. You got the party started
with lightning. We sure did. The rock star has walked in the room.
So we haven't told anyone. We just said we had a special guest coming, and we talked about how handsome we think you are.
Oh, wow. I don't believe a word of it.
Oh, it's so true. All we did was talk about how cute you are. We didn't talk about the fact that you're smart or that you're, like, profound. We are physically, we're just here for the physical.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't hear that very often. So I'm very happy to hear it.
Thank you
very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, friends and family, strangers who are now wondering what's happening, Kristen Bell, Kristen Hange, and I would like to introduce to the podcast Mr. Pete Rollins.
Oh, hello. I'm so honored to be here. I'm sorry I'm running late.
It's so good. We talked about you so much without you here.
Yeah, give us a chance. Well, first of all, it's our 100th podcast episode.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
yeah,
so before you got here, you were on divine timing because we had the perfect amount of time to talk about our 100th episode, to talk about our hearts, talk about the yes inside of our hearts, and also build you up.
Yeah, and I got to make the confession to our audience, which I'll now make to you in person. Yeah. I have told our audience many times about my deep crush for you.
Oh. Shucks. I've got flutters in my heart. Butterflies.
So just so that we let you in on the on the happenings. We love you very much.
That's because you don't know me. So if you get to know me, your attitude would change.
We were saying that Kristen first heard you on Rob's podcast, and then she shared you with me, and we used to just sit in the car and like listen to your voice and feel all the feels.
He's so deep.
Oh,
he's
so
dreamy.
Cute. Listen to him say deep spiritual things with a cute accent.
I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas. I just put this accent on.
You put it on for the ladies.
Yeah, exactly. No one would listen to me if I didn't sound like this, because I say crazy things. So this helps make it easier.
I love it. I think it's important to know your audience and know how you need to people please.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Just kidding.
As a way of like just jumping in, how do you get so interested in the deep things of life? Where did that start?
Wow, that's a good question. I guess, I mean, life is just inherently deep. And we try to run from that a lot, you know, and hide from it. But sometimes my desire is just to try to be as deep as life itself, is to try to, I mean, we're only around for a while. And Socrates once said, an unexamined life is not worth living. And it just sounded better than Netflix. You know what I said? It just sounded like, why not reflect on the weirdness of life? Like, things are so weird. Gravity's weird. None of us think gravity's weird, but it's weird. And it took someone like Newton to see how weird it was and then to, you know, make some really interesting discoveries. So much stuff about life is just as weird as gravity. But we take it for granted because we do it every day. Why do we go out with people who are bad for us? Why do we, you know, self-sabotage? Why do we not desire what we desire? Why do we desire what we don't desire? These are very bizarre things, but we take them for granted. And we're like, okay, well, it'd be fun to try to understand and unpick these really interesting dimensions of human reality while I'm around. I mean, I still like Netflix, but...
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, but you're right. This is so much more interesting.
It's so much more
interesting.
Yeah.
So were you like a teenager just kicking around and like thinking these deep thoughts?
No, not at all. I was a very late developer. I walked there. Like I was three. I think I was three before I walked. I just went around everywhere in my bum. And,
well, can we do that later?
Yeah. that's for this afternoon. I talked really late. They thought there was some problem at speech therapist because I didn't really talk. And then in terms of my intellectual development, that came really late. I failed everything at school and never really read, no interest. It was really when I was 17, I kind of had a set of experiences that opened this up to me. So I was a very late developer, no interest in anything really.
Would you share what those experiences were at 17? Can we ask?
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing that happened. I can put it in like old school language, which I wouldn't use now. But I basically, there were some fundamentalist Christians outside the cinema one day, and they were doing outreach. And I came out of Gremlins 2. I think it was Gremlins 2 I was watching.
Always Gremlins 2.
Yeah, I have to rewatch that. There was actually some musicians. There were quite famous musicians who were doing this. They were doing Jesus mimes. Do you know Jesus mimes? They were creating the pagan sandwich. Do you know the pagan sandwich?
No.
It's where so someone does like a skit, and then you have a row of Christians, and then the pagans come in to see what's happening, and then a row of Christians come in behind, and they create a pagan sandwich. So I was caught in the pagan sandwich. And then got talking to these people who are lovely, lovely people. And they opened up a whole world to me because they were interested in questions that I'd never thought about. Now, I wouldn't come to the same answers necessarily as some of those people. They wouldn't themselves. I know a lot of them now. They're different from when they were 17. But the questions they asked were phenomenal to me. They were asking about what the meaning of life is, about reality, about God, about these deep matters that I'd never thought about. And it so deeply impacted me. And about a week later, I had a breakdown. I was going to a party, and just for no apparent reason, I just burst into tears. Something ruptured within me. I ran to that church, and there were some people there. It was Saturday night. Weirdly, they were a little prayer meeting, and some of them were praying for me, which is ironic. But I came in, and I had this, and I was just like, I want to think about these things. I want to. It was like a change in the way I perceived reality. It was a religious experience, but can I just talk about that for a second?
Yeah. Please.
People think of a religious experience as an experience of something, right? You experience something. Like I take LSD, I have an experience, or I meditate and I have an experience. But in the deep sense, a religious experience isn't an experience of anything. It's what transforms your experience of everything.
Mm.
So you don't really necessarily feel anything, but everything seems different. So it's like life. You don't experience life, but life allows you to experience. So In a weird way, you never experience your life. It's your life that enables all the experiences you have. So a rebirth or a new form of life is not something you experience, but everything is fundamentally changed.
Mm.
And I don't think that's connected necessarily with religion, but I think it's a human possibility that we can have events in our lives that so fundamentally transform how we view everything. And that's what happened when I was 17.
That's stunning. And that really was, like you said, the rupture inside of you was something that just propelled you down a whole new path.
Yeah.
Because there's all new questions you were asking. So now life looks totally different.
Exactly. And nothing was added to my life. This is very key, is that something was subtracted from my life. So again, people think of these experiences where something is added to you. I have 10 experiences in life, but now I have 11 experiences of life or whatever. But for me, conversion in its widest form, not religious form, its widest form, is not an addition. It doesn't add anything to your life. It takes something away. So how I'd explain that is when this happened, I went back to my family, my parents. They were drinking gin and tonic on a Sunday afternoon. And I said to them, I am no longer your son. You hate to break it to you, but I am no longer your child, right? Then we had a pack web, which was quite a shock to them on a Sunday afternoon, drinking their gin and tonic. Then I went into my room and I got rid of everything I owned, got rid of it all. Put it in the living room. They were more annoyed at that than they were about not being their son
I'm
anymore.
I'm no longer your son, but have all my stuff.
Have all my stuff. It's all in the living room. It's like, what? Don't put it in the living room then. Get rid of it. And then I stopped going to tech where I was doing a computer studies course. Now, what was happening there? So I had no understanding. I was dumb. I had never read a book. This was just my immediate response to this event. And in retrospect, I realized what it was about, right? Me saying to my parents, I'm no longer your son, which I apologized for a while later. It took me a while, I have to say, but eventually I came to apologize. But that was me saying that all of the values that you gave to me, wonderful as so many of them are, I just don't feel that they connect with me anymore. I feel like I'm completely new, that that the Northern Irish late 20th century values just don't stick. And when I got rid of my stuff, it wasn't a moral thing. I wasn't St. Francis of Assisi giving all my stuff to the poor. It was just that all of my possessions were symbols of what I valued. And when I looked in my room, I just didn't value any of those things anymore. I mean, wow. I had embarrassing things on my wall. Like I had a great picture of Wendy James from Transvision Vamp. I used to listen to Transvision Vamp, so she's wonderful. And but I had I think I had some fancy car on the wall, that kind of stuff. But all of those things that I valued suddenly didn't mean anything. So I just got rid of them. And then going to tech, it was like my life was just on this track. And suddenly I felt that I could do anything. So nothing was added to my life. Things were stripped away from them. The ideology I was in oscillated. I briefly was in the world, but not of it. And that has remained with me to this very day.
Mm.
I think that experience is an important experience for people.
Yeah, yeah, the moment, it sounds like that there was an awakening to consciousness
that
occurred in that moment,
yeah,
which allowed you to then go through life without being attached to the form.
Yes, that's exactly, like the whole form just, it's almost like if you're watching a movie and you're so into it, but then the screen shakes, like there's something, and suddenly you realize it was just a movie, right? It takes you out of the suspension of disbelief. This was a moment where I was taken out of the suspension of disbelief, that I realized that everything that I took as real was a construct. There's a philosopher called Baudrillard, and Baudrillard talks about Las Vegas and Disney World stuff. And one of the things he says about Las Vegas is that we think that Las Vegas is this fake world, or Disney World is a fake world, and we go into this fake world and we stay in it for a week, and then we go back to our real world. But Baudrillard says, well, it's not quite like that. Disney World makes us think that there is a real world. By being this fake world, we suddenly think that the world we're in is real, but it's just as fake as everything else. But it gives us the illusion that the way you do life, your job, your relationships, all of that is concrete and real and unmalleable. But the truth is, they're both what's called simulacras. They're both copies. They're both things that we can change and transform.
Yeah, it's all Disney World.
Disney World.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the rules in Disney World where you get into a line and go on a ride are as, you know, made up as the rules of I get into my car and I drive to my job.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely. And once you realize that, it's a terrifying because, of course, in reality, you do have to work, pay your bills. So you have to live within this world. But when you realize that it's a formation, you can start to think about, oh, can I rethink this formation? Are there other worlds possible, either in my individual life, politically, in my family? And that's exciting.
Well, I think that's why we love to travel so much, is it's just a wonderful reminder that there are so many different ways to live.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And that different cultures and different places have different also things they have made up,
yeah.
Right? Like when you are in Spain, everybody takes a nap after lunch.
Yeah.
How smart are they?
Exactly.
Right? It's like that, like we could collectively make up different formations that
exactly.
we want to do. And we can be our own creator, our own artist of what is it that we want to live and create.
Exactly. There's a saying, you know the saying, it's a very common saying, a stranger is just a friend you haven't met, right? But I think the opposite is true, more true actually, that a friend is just a stranger you haven't met. In other words, when you think of a friend, someone who's not strange. You just haven't realized how strange they are. You just haven't met the stranger. Right? Yeah.
That's the truth.
That's the truth.
Yeah. And actually, you have to meet the stranger and the other. And one of the reasons for traveling is to realize your own strangeness. So when you go traveling, the first thing you experience is you're bizarre. These people are so bizarre. They've got weird beliefs and practices. But then you see yourself through their eyes and you go, oh my goodness, I'm bizarre. Look at my beliefs and practices. I'm the weirdo, right? And so like, what we do when we encounter otherness, strangeness, is we generally want to do three things. We either want to consume it. In other words, I want to take your weirdness and make it like mine. I want to make you like me. If I can't do that, then I want to vomit you out, which is get rid of you, your otherness. Think of a child puts something in its mouth and it either eats it and becomes part of the body or vomits it out. Or the third is, you know what, beneath all of our differences, we're basically the same. But there, I think the radical thing about traveling is when you realize not that I'm right and you're wrong or that we're both right, let's have tea and biscuits. It's that I'm wrong. I'm a weirdo. And I need your eyes in order to see how strange the way I do family, the way I do community, the way I do culture is. This is, in philosophy, it's going to be called the death of God, which means the death of your world of meaning. Everything that tells you that the way you do family, the way you do politics, the way you do life is right. When you encounter the weirdness of the other, eventually you encounter your own weirdness through their eyes, and you can begin to reimagine your world.
Oh, so deep. Well, and I always think that that kind of happens in a relationship between two people, whether they be friends, whether they be intimate or anything, is all of a sudden you do see your strangeness through their eyes. And you have that opportunity at some point to either, right, vomit them out or go, oh, this is teaching me about my own strangeness that I never would have known.
Absolutely. And it's something that's missing a lot in dating culture in LA and in the US, where often we're really trying to meet someone who is an idealized reflection of ourselves, someone who is not other or strange. And so you have the honeymoon period of a few months where you're going out, and then you encounter their strangeness, and you either try to make them into what you want, which is an idealized form of yourself, or you get rid of them and you start dating somebody else. It's very difficult for all of us to, one, accept the strangeness of the friend, but then even harder is to actually enjoy it and celebrate it and actually realize that that's where the action is. You know,
that's where the juice is.
Yeah, that is, absolutely.
That's where the edge of growth is. We always say that we are the opposites. Like, we look opposites. Our tactics for life are opposites, but we need each other.
Yeah.
I need, and Kristen gets so proud because I'm like very rigid. And I recently, like sometimes Kristen will come over and now my bed won't be made. And she'll say, I've done such a good job.
Yes,
right? Because that would have never happened before my friendship with Kristen. And it's representative of a looseness and open hand that Kristen's able to hold, right? So there's something in the otherness that we're always off. We're always busy making it wrong because we want to defend ourselves somehow.
Yeah.
But when you can accept and say, what's here for me? What's the gift? Where am I curious about this other thing?
Exactly.
Then there's an opening there.
And I love how you said celebrating that thing that at first is an aversion to you.
Yes.
Right? So I become in a new conversation with it when I no longer make it wrong. I welcome it.
Yes. I mean, that's where novelty erupts. Because if you think of a defense mechanism like splitting, where when someone breaks up, they often think, oh, the other person's awful and I was innocent, right? That's splitting. Right? Yeah. They're bad and terrible. I didn't do anything wrong. And I can understand why people do that. It's simply a defense against suffering.
Yes.
Right? You cannot, the tsunami of pain that is like threatening to drown you is too much. Nothing wrong with that. That's what defense mechanisms are there for. If you don't have a defense mechanism, something even worse will happen and you'll kill yourself or something like that. So defense mechanisms are important. They protect us from what's even worse.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which is why, by the way, often it's some drugs that lower your defense mechanism can increase your chance of suicide, because they're actually taking away the very thing that is biologically attempting to save you. But so you have a defense and you're splitting and the other's bad and you're good. And you're saying this to your friends, right? Oh, they're awful, they're terrible, I'm innocent. A good friend won't challenge that or accept it. They'll listen to you. And eventually, when there's a little hesitation in your voice, they might go, you know what? I just think you're hurt. I think you're in a lot of pain. And if you say that at the right moment, the defences lower a little bit enough for them to have a more complex view of the situation. Maybe I wasn't all innocent in this. Maybe I was involved in some way. And the main reason to lower the defence mechanism isn't for any moral reason necessarily. It's just if you don't do that, you'll never have another good relationship. You'll never be able to move on. You'll never be able to shake that person's hand, see them in the street and wish them well. Your defences will actually cause more trouble than they save you from. And so for me, lowering the defences and opening up, it's a way to let novelty appear, let new things arise, something to happen. And in the same way that when we open ourselves up to the weirdness of the other and we allow ourselves to experience it, it's just great because something new is going to happen. You're going to change. Something in your life is going to not be the same. That's exciting. Mm. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Pete, what do you think we're here for?
Easy breezy question. I will say one thing about that. I hear, by the way, like people who think that just because a great question is asked that you have to give a great answer.
I hope you don't.
Yeah.
I hope you say like McDonald's.
McDonald's, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's actually Netflix. I've got shares in Netflix.
I love a callback.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, good callback, exactly. You know, here's my thoughts on this philosophical response to this question of what's it all about? What is meaning? I think the first thing to remind ourselves of is the weirdness of that question, the beauty of the question. Dogs are not sitting asking, what's the meaning of life? Cats aren't, rocks aren't. This drink, this water is not asking, what is the meaning of life? Heidegger, the philosopher, talked about human beings are, first of all, a weird creature for whom meaning is a question to them. And so a weird way of responding is perhaps the meaning of life is to be a creature who can cultivate a sense of the meaning of life. Because meaning of life is basically overvaluing something. Animals are great utilitarians, which means they seek pleasure and lack of pain. Humans are terrible utilitarians because we overattach. We put so much meaning in things that sometimes we're willing to kill ourselves for something. That's weird, that human beings are able to overvalue. We're able to give a value to something that transcends our calculations, our economy. Like every day we decide what to do in terms of, will this be good for me or bad for me, make me happy or sad? And then we encounter a person who we go, I don't care about that calculation. I will destroy myself for that person. Like that cause, like suddenly the economic considerations that govern 99% of our life is thrown out. So for me, partly the meaning of life for me is to ask yourself, what is it that draws out that side of you, what's called ultimate concern for Paul Tillich. It's a beautiful term. What's your ultimate concern? And how do you give yourself to that in a healthy way? Because there are unhealthy ways of ultimate concern as well. That would take too long to get into. But, you know, you can die for your country in a bad way, like, you know, right or wrong, I'm going to die for my country. Or you can die for your country in a good way. I believe my country stands for justice and democracy. And if it does not live up to those standards, I will sacrifice myself fighting for that because that's what my country is for. That's a good form of ultimate concern. So for me, to approach an answer of what it's all about is to approach the question in ourselves, what is it that transcends economic concern for me? Mm. What cause or what person or what whatever it is, and how can I orient my life to that?
Mm. That's so largely what we, because we talk largely to artists and creators. I mean, we believe that everybody is a creator. Everyone has creative energy inside of them. But we're always saying to people that creative spark that's inside of you that's trying to get your attention, that's like let's be concerned about that. Yeah. Like, let's be concerned about the thing that wants to be created through me or the questions that are inside of me instead of just moving around the furniture out here all the time.
Absolutely. That's very similar to what this idea of ultimate concern is. It's about to be human is to have ultimate concern. To be alive, this is a funny thing to say, but I'll say it anyway, but is to be alive is to be a protest against death. Right? No matter what is, everything that exists is a protest against nothingness. This table is a protest against nothingness. This microphone is a protest against nothingness. Our lives, just by purely being, stands out from nothingness. Maybe the most depressing way of saying it is we are a detour between two deaths, right? The nothingness before and the nothingness after. And so the very fact that you exist is a protest against nothingness and non-being. It's an affirmation of life. It's what Tillich calls the courage to be. And everyone has that. And all humans have this ultimate concern at some level within them. And you, as you say, the creative spark. And a lot of it is about how do we fan that into life and how do we orient our lives around it productively.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I was curious about and was talking to Nat about is for you, and you consider yourself a philosopher, so if you're going to say this is what I, what is your edge of growth right now? What is the thing in your in yourself, the question that you are turning over actively?
Yeah, like very concretely, like what my...
I was curious when I woke up in the morning. What's Pete thinking about in his own life? Like, what is the thing that's coming up in your own life that's causing you to ask bigger questions?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Because there's kind of the question of what's intriguing me intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the question of kind of what experientially motivates you. It sounds like you're more interested about the latter.
What's life giving you right now that's causing you to go,
there's something here.
There's something. Life is always giving you stuff. I'll tell you this. It's hard to know how personal to get in a podcast, you know, where I talk about how much I'm annoyed with my mum or something. I'm not annoyed with my mum, that's why I can say she's a lovely woman. And, but I think a lot of the motivation that's got me interested in life and these questions has more been around relationships. And I think, like, for some people, it's job. Some people, it's religion. For some people, it's relationships. I think that... I'm interested in how, in our culture, we can often have a very religious notion of a relationship where we think the other will satisfy us, make us whole and complete. So that's kind of a very religious notion. There's something out there that will make you whole and complete. Causes all sorts of problems, right? And I think a lot of this stuff that has motivated me is, well, what does a healthy relationship look like? What is, instead of thinking that I can find someone who will somehow stop me from desiring, as in satisfy my desire, and so it is happily ever after. What does it look like after the happily ever after, whenever two people or a family are trying to work out how to live well together? And I guess maybe that's too abstract as well, but I think a lot of what has motivated my work is, what does healthy community look like? What is it? What does healthy relationship look like? It's not easy, and it can be very difficult, and there's no guarantees that you can make community work, but a lot of the impetus for my thinking has come from questions about that.
Yeah.
But I still feel I'm dodging your questions. that's fine. Dodge questions.
Maybe for podcast 200, we'll revisit the question.
Do you have any answers for us? What do you think causes healthy relationships?
Concretely, it'll look obviously different for every single person. But abstractly, I think there are certain things that are healthy and good. For example, struggle, embracing the struggle instead of trying to avoid the struggle of a relationship is important. To try to find ways, I'll use this description. I want to make a distinction between what could be called happiness and joy, right? Mm-hmm. Happiness and joy. And to make them technical for a second, of course, in everyday life, we use them interchangeably. But happiness could be said to be the pleasure you get from having something. So getting a nice cup of coffee, going to the cinema, hanging out with friends. Happiness is the pleasure of getting something you want. Christmas, opening the present. Joy is the pleasure you get from not having what you want. So... think about it like,
we're clutching our pearls and holding our hearts, so everyone has the visual.
So think of it like Christmas, where you've got a kid and they're going, I can't, Christmas is a week away and I really want my present, and they're having temper tantrums and all that. But you can tell they're really loving it, right? They're so excited. That's joy. Joy is, they don't have the present, but they're enjoying the anticipation, the hope. They're enjoying the not having, basically, right? And then actually pleasure is really momentary. Like opening the present is always a bit of a disappointment. Even when you get what you want, it's fun for a bit. But joy is, like, so when you go on holiday, you're not paying for the holiday. You're also paying for the fantasy of going on the holiday. That's why you shouldn't book your holiday a day in advance, right? Because part of what you're paying for is the fantasy of how great it's going to be. It's not going to be that great. We all know that, right? So at least get the fantasy.
Yes.
Or a lottery ticket. In analytic philosophy, that I remember when I started philosophy, they do a thought experiment. Is it rational to play the lottery? And of course, the answer is technically no. But the thing they never talked about in this thought experiment is that you're not just paying for the lottery ticket. You're also paying for the fantasy of what you'd do if you would win.
Mm.
And in fact, that's probably where the real enjoyment of the lottery ticket is, right? Is you pay $1 and you start thinking about all the stupid things you'd buy. Worst thing that happens if you won, because then you buy them and you realize they don't make you happy, right? It's only as you fulfill your dreams that you realize your dreams do not fulfill you. And that's a traumatic moment. But so that's joy in a sense. But the thing is, we can't enjoy our enjoyment. In our society, we want the pleasure, the happiness, the thing at the end that's going to satisfy us. But joy, and joy is a theological category, actually. Joy is this notion that you can enjoy the struggle of life. You can find pleasure in causes. You can. It's actually the what's called the rebel. Albert Camus called it the rebel, right? The conservative for Camus is someone who thinks utopia, the kingdom of God, is in the past, right? In that last relationship, in the 1950s golden age, when I was a child, right? The utopia is behind and we need to get it back. And they're unhappy until they can get it back. The liberal is the one who the utopia is in the future. It's something to be grasped ahead of us, right? And they're not happy until they grasp it. And then Camus talks about the rebel. The rebel is slightly different from both, because the rebel enjoys the struggle of not having the utopia. They still fight for things, they want things, but they enjoy it. So the ultimate rebel is in the wild ones, that Marlon Brando.
Yes.
Yeah, this he's in the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, yeah. And he's in this coffee shop, and this waitress says to him, Johnny, what are you rebelling against? And he looks at her and he says, what have you got? What have you got, right? And you can tell that he loves it. He's the rebel. He's enjoying the struggle.
Mm.
And that's what joy is. And if you can have that in a relationship, I think that you're going to have something good.
Oh, thank you for that, Mr. Pete Rollins.
Your relationship advice. I get anything else. Yeah, that's what I should do. Maybe there'd be more money in that.
Should we hit Pete with
the big question?
With the big question.
Okay.
So, those weren't the big questions.
Those are not the big questions.
Wow.
We have one.
That was the appetizer.
Yeah. We have one that we're really excited to ask you. And maybe we'll give you the prelim. So
yeah.
There's a teacher that I love named Michael Beckwith, and he talked about ecstatic bliss. Like ecstatic bliss being the vibration or the nature of the divine, right? And that got me really high just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Cut to Natalie and I in dance class, and it was like a Latin dance class, and we were in the front of the class. We are not technically good dancers.
Not even technically, not like physically
or in rhythm, any of that stuff. But what we lack in technique, we make up for in enthusiasm and imagination. So we're in the front, and we are dancing full out, swinging our hips, pelvic thrust, tossing our hair.
When we forget the moves, we just start jumping.
Yeah.
And like throwing
swaying.
Our hands in the air.
And in our minds, we were on a sandy beach nightclub dancing with hot, sweaty Latin men and throwing back tequila shots. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's like 8 a.m.
I fantasize about that all the time.
We leave.
It's like you're talking about my inner work.
Exactly. So we leave this dance class and we're just turned on, high vibes, the whole thing. And we were like, you know what that was? That was dirty bliss.
Dirty bliss.
Yes,
and then
nice.
And then we couldn't stop like moving our hips.
Mm.
Like, oh, dirty bliss. That's a thing.
Dirty bliss. And then we were like, what's the gospel of dirty bliss?
And we're like, let's ask Pete Rollins.
Oh, I actually have something I can say. This is hilarious. That's
we may even know. We're like, we're going to tell him that's what this podcast is called and just see what he says.
Dirty bliss.
Dirty
Pete Rollins.
The gospel of dirty bliss.
Well, this reminds me of a really good friend of mine called the Reverend Vince Anderson. And the Reverend Vince Anderson is in New York. He's a New York guy. And he has this set every week, and he's been doing it for 15 years now. It starts like 11 o'clock at night, goes on to 2 o'clock in the morning. It's just jammed, this famous club in Brooklyn. I forget the name of the club off the top of my head, but I used to go. And what he does is called Dirty Gospel. He's called it Dirty Gospel. And you have a room of hundreds of people, and he is basically preaching from the front. He sometimes strips naked. He hangs from the chandelier. He's got this Reverend Vince Anderson on the Love Choir. And when I watched him do this, he calls it Dirty Gospel, and he gets out into the crowd. He's touching people with his sweaty hands, and that guy gets sweaty, very, very sweaty. And he is like, preaching over people like it's a fundamentalist revival meeting. And at first I was like, is this like a performance art? I thought this is performance art. But I found out he is actually a reverend. He works within churches. And and it is a performance, but it's also authentic. And it's exactly what you describe. It's this room. And I say it's hundreds of cynical Brooklyn hipsters who are dancing all through the Monday night, jammed hundreds of them to this dirty gospel that feels both transcendent and imminent. It's the grit and grime of the world.
The primal.
The primal that opens up the transcendent. That's key to the work that I'm interested in, actually.
The primal that opens up the transcendent. That's the work I'm interested in.
Yeah.
That's all we want to do.
Yes.
In philosophy, it's called dialectics, right? Which I love this term, dialectics. But and this is actually my intellectual work at the moment, is trying to articulate this. A dialectic, in the sense, rejects something, absolutely rejects the past, 100%. And in rejecting the past, it actually somehow affirms the truth of what it rejects. So in the face, say, for example, the rejection of the transcendent, of God above, who we all die and we go to heaven, everything's great, right? The absolute rejection of that and the embrace of the grit and grime of the world, you then actually affirm a transcendence that you've rejected. But it's like the deeper you go into the no, the more you find the yes.
We all just want to hold each other.
We all want to get sweaty and hold each other.
We're going to have a dance party after
this.
Yes,
that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
Kristen,
what's happening.
Get the music going. I am not going to dance. I couldn't do that. After saying all of that, I can't let myself go in that way. And for the sake of humanity, I'd maybe be able to do it on my own.
No, but we could show you. We actually showed Rob and Kristen a video of us in our dance class because we wanted to prove that we're not just being self-deprecating. We wanted to prove
like how
we actually did a video, and I'll never forget
Rob.
Us showing Rob, and he said, "Wow, yeah, that's not good at all."
Well, have you ever heard of a static dance?
A static dance?
Yes. A static dance is actually all about, they put on like tribal music and you go and you just let your body move. But the whole thing is to find the unself-consciousness, and it's especially powerful for men to allow themselves to move without being aware of what they look like.
I know. I don't know if I could. I've done many things in my life, many things I'm not proud of, but I don't know if I could do that. Maybe I have to try.
Maybe it's our mission.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe it's our new vocation.
To an ecstatic dance party.
Yeah. I mean, when you start to see us dance, you'll feel very free.
I know, but you guys are actors and theaters. Like, that's your part of your whole job, is to get over your inhibitions. My inhibitions
would
keep me together. If I got rid of my inhibitions, I don't know what would happen.
Well, I say you go deep into the no and find your yes.
All right, because I'm Irish, and the Irish are very repressed people. There's one comedian who said that the Irish are the type of people who, they keep everything down, they don't talk about anything, they don't talk about anything, they don't talk about anything, they keep it all repressed, and then finally, they die. And that's what I do. So I'm busy keeping everything down, and it will eventually kill me. My heart will literally explode. The repression will be so much.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, on that, can we do a whole other topic of a podcast sometime on the topic of going into the primal to find transcendence?
Oh yeah, I'd love to. That's why I was late, because I was literally giving a talk about this very thing.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait.
Yeah, so.
All right, so next time we're in
everything
town,
we want to talk about.
Yes.
we'd love to do dialectics, or and we'll find a better way to put it, mm-hmm. which is going into the primal to find the transcendent. Yeah. Yeah. And the funny thing is, so there's what's called non-dialectic no's. And a non-dialectic no is when you reject something in the past, but there's no affirmation in it. And there's no discovery of it, of what can be called a post-apocalyptic event. Because apocalypse is like something happens, you don't know what's going to happen next, right? A non-dialectic no rejects everything in the past, but as I say, there's no affirmation and no new creation comes out of it. So for example, somebody might reject their religious past, right? They grew up conservative Christian or something, for example, and they reject it all, and they should reject it all because maybe it damaged them. It hurt them or their family. But if it's a non-dialectic no, what happens is a new form of life doesn't birth. And often what you do is you end up, to be honest, just taking some alternative. Suddenly you, another religious idea, or you make fame or money or looks or something else into your God. And a dialectic no rejects fundamentally your past, but in the rejection of it, the terms become something else. So grace, forgiveness, salvation, those terms become something radically different that you could never have imagined. And it's called overcoming nihilism. You enter into the nihilistic no, but that no gives birth to almost a reinterpretation of your past. You carry something with it that's beautiful. And so I think for people, whenever you're rejecting something damaging from your past, it's good to ask yourself, is this a dialectic no, or is it a non-dialectic no? Is it a no that has an affirmation in it that will lead to a post-apocalyptic new something, or is it just what Nietzsche called resentment? Like, so resentment is basically, so we all have resentment sometimes. If I see, you know, Kristen there getting a really good job that I want, I kind of maybe resent her a little bit, right? Rob, that's a good example. You know, he writes a book, and I'm like, I wish I'd written that, right? And a little bit of resentment, that's fine. There's no problems with that, because you go like, oh, it's just me, you have to get over it. Resentment is where that's a spiritual condition, where everything that is healthy you see as sick, everything that is strong you see as weak, everything that is good you see as bad. And Nietzsche says it like this. He says, there are some people who are so sick that everything that is healthy becomes sick. And then he says, and there are some people who are so healthy that even when they're sick, they see health. And that's why there's a phrase he says, with that which does not kill you makes you stronger. He doesn't mean that in the sense of course it doesn't happen. If you have cancer, you survive it, you may be weaker. But what he means is there is a condition in which if you're so affirmative of being, of existence, that even when you see sickness, you will be able to bring something beautiful out of it. Mm. But so resentment is a non-dialectic no. It says no to everything, but there's no yes to it. There's no affirmation to it. But a healthy type of no is not resentment. It's a no that says that was life-destroying, that was life-eating, that was death-dealing. And you say no to it. But in saying no to it, you discover that there was something in what you reject that had life, that you could only see when you gave it up. Mm. So yeah, so that's what we talk about all of that sometimes. Yeah, dialectic.
See, friends, does everyone see now?
Why we have such big crushes on Pete Rollins. And don't you now too?
Now you're all going to everyone's Googling him right now. Yeah. I can feel it.
I know that.
I'm worried about what's out there.
There's a great picture of you with like a leather jacket up against the brick. Oh, that's the
one. Yeah.
I lost that leather jacket recently. I'm so depressed. I was actually hoping I left it here. I leave the leather jacket. No. It's like my favorite leather jacket. I lose everything when I'm traveling. Everything. But I like losing a leather jacket.
Oh,
I think
man.
It's that one that, and I can't buy it again.
It's the one you had at the warehouse.
Was it which warehouse?
Oh, I don't know. The one that looked like the Ralph Lauren.
Oh. No, I've still got that one. Oh yeah, I got this leather jacket for $60 that I love, but it's brown, so it doesn't go with very much. This was this grey leather jacket.
This was this grey, yeah.
Yeah, and that's gone. That's
well, you know what?
And that gave me fullness of life, right? I'm talking about the struggle of life, but when I got that leather jacket, it was like...
Well, and it gave us fullness of life.
Yes, I mean, obviously,
we were all happy. Yeah.
We will hold the vision of a brand new jacket coming into your life.
Oh, thank you.
It's even better.
Even better. Oh, wow.
See,
okay.
What's that, the liberal? The good is in the future?
In the future, yes. I'm not even happy until I get it. that's bad.
We love you so much. We're so grateful for your time.
Such a joy.
We're so grateful for who you are. And thank you for asking these big questions that touch something so deep in us that cause us to see the world.
Wow. Listen, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kristen, for letting us crash.
The best ever.
The best ever. We kidnapped Kristen for Girls Weekend.
Is that right? Did you have a Girls Weekend? Well, or are you
a Girls
Morning.
Well, Girls Morning. Morning. Yeah. Well, I mean, we want to take her to Mexico, but we're working on it.
Yeah. It's all in process. You can come to Mexico,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting for. I'm right here, everybody, you know?
We're going to be dancing. You can come dance with sweaty Latin men if you like.
Yeah,
I feel like the meaning of life is somewhere in Mexico with Latin men.
I've never been, well, I've been to Mexico once, across the border. I went to a really cool town right at the border, drank tequila, but only for an afternoon. So someday I have to go back.
So
do you do stuff? You do a lot of stuff in Mexico?
We will
do
now. All right, so signing off to our beautiful friends listening, you are all welcome to come to Mexico too.
Thank you so much for listening. We love to feel like we have friends all over the world in you who are committed to doing their dream on the planet.
And if you liked this podcast and you want to find out more about what we're doing or who we are, our pop-up classes, our online classes, you can check all of that out at thecreateseries.com.
And if you want to be part of our Facebook community, you can go to the Create Community page. That's C.R.E.A.T.E. community.
And if you loved this podcast, why not share it with a friend?